Good morning. It's good to be here with you this morning again and have those here with us to join in worshiping God. This is Labor Day weekend, so we have a number of people out of town traveling, and Labor Day weekend is kind of a nice time to take a trip and take a vacation, even though on the one hand you'd think it's so, you know, close to the start of school. People still make those kinds of plans and like to travel, so I figured we'd travel again today. Last week we looked at and studied Capernaum, and it's been really neat to look at some of these different Bible places and lands because of how helpful they are to make these Bible stories come alive and to really appreciate what went on there. There's actually a group that's, I suppose you could call them Appian Media is the title they have on their group, that has been doing a number of travels into these biblical lands and making videos. A couple of Church of Christ preachers who are involved in that, as well as some people who film and things like that. And it's just been awesome to be able to watch some of those and just really, you know, live that story and to just have some of those things nuanced to appreciate it, as well as some of the different finds that have been made to just further give that evidence that these things really happen. And so as we look to do some of that this morning, I thought another place that really depicts some helpful things from a Bible story in the book of Acts is Athens. Drake said that, Brian, if you could go one place on a trip, where would it be? And he said, my mom would say Greece. And so this is for you, Pam. In any case, Athens is what we'll be looking at. And this is just kind of like a picture from some of the city at large that really looks out at the Acropolis. And we'll talk about that in a minute. But man, there are just some incredible ancient things that still stand here that were made well before New Testament times. You can just kind of see from the outset, depending on which angle you take a picture from in Athens and looking at the Acropolis, you can see some of modern day Greece and then a lot of ancient Greece. And so this is something that ends up being quite an attraction for people just in general. You know, some of the movies that have been set in Greece and some of just the romantic things that go on there, that kind of a thing. People would just want to go just because of those aspects, let alone the incredible biblical aspects in Athens. This is going to be a place that Paul will visit and journey on his second missionary trip, or at least what we typically call Paul's second missionary journey. I don't know if Paul was like, okay, I'm going on my second missionary journey now. But, you know, to make things easy for us, those are the kinds of titles we see in our Bibles and things of that nature. Of course, Paul had taken a trip really more so throughout this region of ancient biblical lands. And now he's going to take another one, and it's going to start back in Jerusalem. Just to kind of provide a little bit of background that leads up to this trip and some of the things that we'll get to look at in a moment. In Acts chapter 15, you're going to have a council at Jerusalem regarding the circumstance of the Gentile inclusion into God's people and God's church. Of course, this is going to be the groundbreaking thing that happens to a large degree for the Jews. Not only will they have the Messiah come and be this fulfillment and provide the salvation, but that salvation will extend to the Gentiles. And you get to first see that with Cornelius. And this ends up creating some problems, as the Jews had always expected salvation to come through them, and not just them as a Jew who would spread that news, but by becoming Jewish. That's how they thought this plan would unveil. And so even with that, you still have people thinking that if Gentiles are going to have the gospel preached, okay, that's fine, but they've got to be circumcised. They've got to partake of these different acts of Judaism and Jewish culture. And so circumcision is a sign of the covenant that to some degree would make one Jewish, and that's what they're instructing on people. And so the apostles say, okay, we've got to set the record straight. Let's go ahead and get some of these different Christians together and some of the leaders to be able to confirm that this is absolutely God's plan, and make sure the rest of these Christians know that that's the case. And so they gather at Jerusalem, and you have them just talk about what God has done, provide them different proofs, and talk about this experience with Cornelius. And so that all is accomplished. And now they're going to go and revisit some other churches. And Paul and Barnabas end up taking part in this council, so to speak. And so as they go and they're going to tell that church in Antioch all these things that had happened, they actually write up a letter of kind of, okay, this is the instructions that we're going to offer to the Gentiles to make sure that we can kind of break some of these barriers and be able to have good relationship with them and tell them what to expect as well. After they go to Antioch, they're going to go ahead and start making their rounds back to those churches that were established in that first missionary trip. So Paul and Barnabas, if you remember, they were those who were called by God to do that. And so they get ready to go, except you have a little bit of a dilemma where Paul is not interested in bringing along John Mark. So you have this passage where John Mark had left them previously on their trip, and Barnabas, he wants to take John Mark along. And a sharp disagreement rises among them, is how it's typically termed in the Bible there. And they end up deciding, okay, we'll just part ways. You go visit these areas, I'll go visit these. And just as a side note, as we talk about this, to me that's been a really neat scripture to appreciate as I've grown. To have a biblical example and precedent by an apostle and one who God is using in this incredible way, Barnabas, who disagree on a matter pertaining to serving God. In fact, I think that's really what the point is by that term, sharp disagreement. Not that it's saying it was so sharp that they were just attacking each other and just, you know, hailing insults and raising voices. But the point that they could not come to agreement on what to do over John Mark. So the solution was to separate. And, you know, it's funny because sometimes you look at this and you kind of consider who's right and who's wrong. Or who sinned? You know, if these Christians did this, what took place here? Was Barnabas right? Because John Mark ends up being a pretty crucial, you know, person in the New Testament church and does some great things. I mean, was Paul right? I think a lot of people tend to be like, oh yeah, Barnabas just had a lot of mercy and grace. So I think what you can appreciate and consider as you think through the situation is both had good, godly motives, perhaps, for making those decisions. Barnabas wanted to give John Mark another chance. Also, there may have even been a factor that they have a family relation tie. So they actually are related. I believe they're cousins of sorts. But in any case, Paul may be thinking, we're being entrusted by God with the deliverance of the gospel to these territories, and this is going to be some hard news to offer some people. And Mark left before. Being considerate of this work that we're going to engage in, I can't trust him for this particular task at this particular time. Of course, later Paul will commend him, but I think that that's what's amazing, is to see that Christians can disagree, that it's okay in different instances. And that doesn't mean they can disagree about anything and everything, but disagreements can be had. And perhaps what you see is that while Christians can disagree, that doesn't mean that they're disagreeable or that you can't disagree in love. And that sometimes, you know, a separation is necessary to be able to have both parties serve the Lord the best that they can. And how God can even use something like this to help spread his plan. Now you have two groups. Previously you had one. Now Paul and Barnabas, they split up and they take other people along. Now you've got two missionary trips. But in any case, this is what kind of sets the stage for Paul making this trip ultimately to Athens. He ends up taking along Silas, and they're going to initially go to Syria and Cilicia. Timothy's converted. He becomes a companion that travels with him. Lydia as well. It's kind of neat to see just this statement in chapter 16, verses 4 and 5. As they traveled from town to town, they delivered the decisions reached by the apostles and elders in Jerusalem for the people to obey. So the churches were strengthened in faith and grew daily in numbers. They go back to those different towns and churches that had been previously established, and they give them that much more strength. They're encouraged by this, and they're given some instruction. And so as they're going, they're looking to continue on in Asia. That's where some of these churches were. And as they're going along in Asia, this region, they're trying to go to Bithynia, and you see that the Holy Spirit prevents them. And it's around this time that they get a Macedonian call. We have record of Paul having a vision of this man in Macedonia who stands and begs him, come to Macedonia, we need help. And so from there, they end up changing their plans. You know, initially they're going to continue in this area, perhaps go on further. God has other plans in mind, and they end up going to Philippi. They end up traveling to Macedonia, this region, and ultimately Achaia. It's in Philippi that they meet the jailer while they're in prison. You also have Lydia converted. And then they're going to go to some of these other places, Thessalonica and then Berea. In fact, in Thessalonica, that's where you have some of those Jews who start to cause some of the trouble. This is just kind of a foreshadow of things to come for Paul. As you see in his later trip, it seems like anywhere he goes, he's going to have Jews follow him, stirring up strife and causing trouble, whether it be over the Gentile situation or other situations. And here they end up saying that they're causing a riot, and Paul's someone who's just this troublemaker who's bringing people away from Caesar. You know, the same claim that they made about Jesus is what they're saying about Paul. Oh yeah, he's a disruptor and he's a rebellious person, like the Jews care about Caesar. They don't like Paul. They don't like Jesus and this message. And so they flee to Berea, where you have these noble-minded Bereans. And actually, even here, Paul will split from Silas and Timothy, who've been traveling with him, because these Jews, and he goes to wait for them in Athens. So Athens, it's kind of interesting to think about this. By the time Paul reaches Athens, this isn't on his, you know, route list. This isn't necessarily a priority of, okay, I'm going to go and I'm going to establish a church there. This is kind of a side note of what Paul has in mind. In fact, you're going to see this in chapter 17. It says, while Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as the marketplace day by day with those who happened to be there. You know, that's what's so cool about Paul. You know, this isn't in his plans. This isn't what he previously set out to do, just like Macedonia wasn't in his previous plans. But if that's where he's going to go, that's where he's going to work. And that's where he's going to offer the gospel. And here, he's going to offer the gospel in Athens, a place full of idols. And so when we come to Athens, Athens is a place that is named after the goddess Athena. This is a supposed virgin goddess who sprang from the head of Zeus, very powerful and prominent goddess that people worshipped in Athens and in Greece, usually shown wearing a helmet with an aegis with the head of Medusa. Certainly some interesting imagery there. But she would be the goddess of wisdom, the patron of the arts, of war and peace, ruler of storms, and the guardian of Athens. So a prominent figure, obviously. I mean, the place is named after her, associated with the Roman goddess Minerva, and honored with her own festival named the Panathenaea, and with Greece's most famous temple, the Parthenon. So this is a city that has some very pivotal concerns and loyalties to a number of different gods. Athena is going to be just one, in fact, of many. It mentions, you know, that they have this festival that goes on. This is a picture of the Acropolis. The Acropolis in Athens is this high place, this hill, that you'd be able to see pretty well from anywhere in Athens, that had a number of different monuments and things that really honored these gods. And as you had the Romans come in later, of course, you know, the Romans have come during Paul's time and had its influence. They set up different things as well. And so the Acropolis is something that Paul would have been one of the first sites that Paul could see as he's entering in. And it's on that big hill that you end up seeing the Parthenon. And so this is what remains of the Parthenon today. And again, this is the temple of Athena. It was probably began during the second half of the 5th century and is going to be the most famous building on this Acropolis. Again, you know, just this whole town being named after this goddess that it houses. But you're going to have some other things that take place there, different monuments of Athena. But just to give you an idea and appreciate a little bit more, you can see some of the people here down below, just to have a little bit of a scale. Actually, if you go to Nashville, Tennessee, they made a replica. I actually got to visit it. I didn't even know what it was really at the time, but it is huge. And it's supposed to have housed an image of Athena. And it's likely that this large image of a wooden statue of the goddess stood there. And you can see some of these different aspects. Again, this god of war and wisdom. There's that crown that kind of has some of that aspect of Medusa. But this is what they have in Nashville as a sort of possible replica of the goddess as well. Here's another picture to just kind of, again, appreciate some of the scale. It's mentioned that Athens, during the time of Paul, had more images than all the rest of Greece put together. And when I say images, images of gods and goddesses. Every public building also served as a sanctuary dedicated to one or more gods. So even in the marketplace, the marketplace is called the Agora, and essentially you would have a number of different, you know, selling and buying going on. But even those different places, a lot of times they would really be those who would advocate a particular god, and had very many. We'll see some different things there in just a minute. Patronus, a Roman, said it's easier to find a god than a man in Athens. So again, just extremely theological. And besides mythological gods, such as Athena and others, the Athenians personified and worshipped as deities all sorts of abstract virtues and truths, such as love, joy, peace, etc. So you'd have Zeus, or you'd have Athena, you'd have Isis, but then you'd have the god of love. Or, you know, some of them also, you know, obviously kind of intertwine, you know, a god of war, but actually they would kind of add some of this on. Again, just to appreciate, this is the temple of Isis that is in the marketplace. So just kind of as you pass through, and certainly the marketplace, while there'd be buying and selling in part of this city, you'd also have a lot of discussion going on about theology and philosophy. The Stoics and Epicureans are going to end up being prominent members at play in Paul's experience in this trip, and certainly in this region. And we'll get to that in just a minute. But a lot of talk being going around, and Paul takes advantage of that. This is also on the Acropolis, and it's called the Nike Bastion and Temple of Athena Nike. If you know Terrence very well, he likes Nike. You know, not the shoe and the brand, but he likes the concept and that term. It actually comes, it's a Greek word that means victory. And so he's talked about that in Revelation in particular, how it's through Jesus that we're victorious, and how that ends up being used by Paul as far as that term and that concept. But this also ends up being a term and concept used by these pagans who would worship idols. And so victory is something that is worshipped in relation to Athena. You know, again, mention how they worship not just these figures, but these concepts. This is an aspect of that. This particular smaller temple over here is to be able to give homage to the god of victory and how that associates to Athena. So it's a representative of being victorious in war, being able to worship in this manner. So the citizens worship the goddess in hopes of a successful outcome in the long Peloponnesian War fought against the Spartans and their allies. And so, again, just pretty amazing to have those remains. That's on that Acropolis. So that's something that would be seen just about from anywhere. Another big thing that remains today is the Temple of Zeus. The Olympian temple there that has a number of parts that still stand. So this is going to be a piece of that. You have a couple of pillars in the back. Many of these have fallen. These are just a couple of things... facts about that. The Temple of Zeus, also known as the Olympion or Columns of the Olympian Zeus, is a former colossal temple at the center of the Greek capital in Athens. So not only do you have an Acropolis, this high place that houses the, you know, temples of Athena, you've got a bunch of things just in the city, in the marketplace, just, you know, monuments in the center of this capital that worship all these gods, that as Paul is coming through, he'd be walking by this, and he'd be walking by that, and he'd be looking up and seeing that Acropolis. This is the head of the gods, Zeus, and construction began in the 6th century, but wasn't completed actually until later in the 2nd. Certainly a lot of this would have been done by the time of Paul, and it includes 104 colossal columns. It was renowned as the largest temple in Greece. In fact, their intention when building it is to make it the largest temple in the world, the largest and most beautiful temple in the world for this god of Zeus. And it housed one of the largest cult statues in the ancient world. This is kind of a picture of what it might have looked like in that time when it was standing. So here's the remains that you see, and then here's just, you know, kind of the makeup of around it. And again, that's people in scale to it. Pretty incredible. Oh, that was supposed to be on the next slide. Yeah, actually one of the columns fell in 1852, apparently. And, you know, again, those are some of the remains of that. There is also a theater of Dionysus that you can see. It's kind of at the base. Actually, in this picture, it doesn't have what's going to later be built up that you can see from some of the other pictures. But another piece of that was later built, I believe, in the 50s. But it's dedicated to Dionysus, the god of plays and wine, among other things. So, you know, that's part of the activities and customs and hobbies that people would have. You'd go to the play. And you'd drink wine and have pleasure and be merry. And so let's have a god of those things. So this theater that's built so that they would go and be able to enjoy, you know, different productions, let's dedicate it to this god of Dionysus. You can see just how these minds worked in their mentality as far as how they viewed, you know, gods in that day. But it's pretty big, could seat about 17,000 people, great acoustics. It was the ideal location for ancient Athens' biggest theatrical celebration, the Dionysia, and considered the world's first theater ever built. So this again is kind of at the base of the Acropolis, that sort of hill, and supposedly the birthplace of Greek tragedy. You know, if you know much about Greece and Athens, you know that it's the birthplace of democracy, supposedly. And I mean, there's just a lot of tradition surrounding this place, both, you know, politically as well as theologically and philosophically. We'll get to some of that in a minute as well. But dates back to the 4th century BC. It's going to have a number of remodelings. I apologize. This doesn't have. I apologize. This is kind of faint. But behind it, you have the Asclepion of Athens, which is another god who would be kind of like the god of health. And so this actually served as a sort of hospital where people would go and be able to have different healing aspects done for them. And so, again, just kind of interesting how they associate a god with everything, whether it's pleasure, whether it's... I mean, it's not just like, okay, God is in the church, which in some ways, hey, you know, it's... That's something that you can appreciate to some degree. They incorporated God into everything. maybe we should. But on the other sense, you know, obviously different when you're incorporating pagan idols and false deities. But again, just gives you that impression. And I suppose in some ways you can appreciate this aspect. Mom worked at Barnes Jewish Hospital, and it's a religious hospital. A lot of hospitals are. But... You know, not only were their hospitals religious, again, everything is. And so can you imagine what it would be like living in Paul's time, approaching this city, walking through that marketplace, seeing these different structures, and thinking, I'm going to evangelize here. I wonder what might be going through our minds approaching a city like this. On the one hand, you might think, and maybe some frustration, indignation. Perhaps that's kind of part of what Paul feels, right? His spirit was being provoked within him as he was beholding the city full of idols. You know, here's this man who's a Jew, right? Who's grown up under the knowledge of Yahweh, Jehovah God, who's established and shown himself and manifested himself in the Exodus and through Israel, and he comes to this place where they don't have a clue about this God. You know, that's not a primary emphasis. There are synagogues there, but there is much more other things. And to see that people are engaged in this kind of idolatry, how disappointing that could be. Maybe there'd be fear. As what in the world are these people going to think when I start preaching about not only Jehovah, but Jesus? And what's taking place. You'll be able to perhaps appreciate that a little bit more. Maybe hopelessness. You know, I think about, you know, going door to door and sometimes, you know, going to different places, I'm more optimistic than others. And if every time I went to a house I saw a Buddha or an idol, you know, I wonder what my attitude might be. And to some degree, this example that Paul offers may be helpful for us in such situations. Maybe pity, just acknowledging that they don't have the same sort of knowledge. Or what about hope? You think about hopelessness. What about hope? Isn't it amazing? So he's reasoning in the synagogue with the Jews and the God-fearing Gentiles. And in the marketplace, every day, with those who happen to be present. He doesn't isolate himself just to the Jews. And to some degree, you can appreciate, he's going to the synagogues first. Why? Well, to the Jew first, and also to the Greek, right? They've got a relationship. They've got a commonality. You know, they are going to be the people who are perhaps most interested and willing to hear about Jesus and the fulfillment of what they've been reading of the Messiah. You know, it makes sense that that would be the first place to go. But that isn't what Paul limits himself to. He goes to the marketplace where people are talking about these things. And to anyone who passes by, who happens to be not just the Jews, not just the God-fearing Greeks, but to these Athenian worshipers, to these Zeus worshipers, could have been anybody. I thought it was pretty cool. There was someone who gave this illustration that there were three men who went on a trip, and they ended up coming to just this beautiful view. And these three people, there's one who was a painter, and when he looked out and saw the mountains and this, you know, just gorgeous backdrop, all he could think about was just painting this gorgeous image and what it would look like on the canvas. And then you had a prospector who came, and all he could think about is, man, look at these mountains and this land. If we could only mine this. And then a preacher who looked out, and all he could consider was the great glory of God and God's handiwork. And the point was kind of made, as a man thinks in his heart, so he is. And that can be true, just our perspective of a landscape or our perspective of people who could be prospects for the gospel. You know, we could look at them and think fear or think solely hopelessness. Or think opportunity, possibility, hope. Let's go ahead and look in Acts 17. We'll look in verse 18 through 21. So it says, and also some of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers were conversing with him. Some were saying, what could this idle babbler wish to say? Others, he seems to be a proclaimer of strange deities because he was preaching Jesus and the resurrection. And they brought him and took him to the Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new teaching is which you're proclaiming? For you are bringing some strange things to our ears, so we want to know what these things mean. Now all the Athenians and the strangers visiting there used to spend their time in nothing other than telling or hearing of something new. So Paul is going, he's talking in the marketplace, and he ends up approaching some of these philosophers, some of these Epicureans and Stoics. Not only was Athens a place filled with all of this paganism and mythology and Greek theology, but they're also filled with a lot of philosophy. Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, Demosthenes, and others were incredible influences of this place. In fact, they had different schools set up. Even today, you can go and see some of these different places there. And located, you have the Academy of Plato. Again, all of these different things to really appreciate that, as well as the Areopagus, where the Athenian Supreme Court met. And the Areopagus, again, as they associate everything with God, even if it's not being used for that at the time, is the Hill of Mars. Mars being the god, the war god. Ares in Latin is Mars, the god of war, who, according to mythology, stood trial for slaying the son of Poseidon. And if I don't get the image up here, I thought I had the animation so that we could see the hill first, or this place first. I'll make sure to get that up one way or the other. But the name is also given to a council that met on this hill. And this council was one that had a lot of judicial power. While some of this power declined throughout time during different rule and reign, the authority regarding religious and moral matter remained and commanded great respect even in these Roman times. So during Paul's visit, without waiting for a formal accusation, the court could summon any citizen for the purpose of examining them, and if found guilty of a punishable offense, could convict that person and sentence them up to and including capital punishment. So when Paul goes to this Areopagus and there is this meeting, it's probably informal. It may not have been this sort of council that met, maybe just had members of that council, as you'll end up having an inclination of that. But this would be kind of touchy territory. Yeah, they like to hear things and get news about these. That's their interest. But as far as how to provide this message, you again could appreciate some of the caution one might have approaching this scene. He's coming before people who have power, who can do damage. And he's already run. I mean, the reason he's in Athens, why? Because he ran away from Thessalonica because Jews were trying to kill him there. Socrates was actually tried and convicted on this hill, being accused of being a perverter of accepted religion and corrupting the youth of Athens. He was condemned to die and drank poisonous hemlock and died in what was described as a calm and courageous manner. So actually, a lot of people will visit this site today because, not because of biblical aspects, but because Socrates was held on trial there. And that's where he ended up dying. And, I mean, why is he on trial? Because he provided an unaccepted philosophy or religion. He went against the grain. So this is in Saul's past, or Paul's past. And how easy it could have been to think, man, I mean, if they put Socrates to death, what are they going to do to me preaching Jesus? It mentions that Paul is speaking to the Epicureans, followers of Epicurus. They were atheistic materialists. So you can see how, while they're completely pagan and idol worshippers, you also have this philosophy that comes into play. Kind of like today, right? And their intention and idea was that life wasn't regulated by higher moral or spiritual interests, but that the highest aim was gratification of every pleasure and lust that best satisfied. So in some ways, their belly was their god, so to speak. Their motto might have been more so to enjoy life, to gain understanding and intellect, but only to the extent that it helped you enjoy life. So those are some of the philosophers, and they kind of represent one party. And then you have this other party who are kind of on the exact opposite. They're pantheists. They rejected the idolatry of pagan religions, but taught that God was merely a spirit of reason in the universe. So a higher knowledge, that's the God that they're trying to serve. Pleasure is not good. Pain isn't necessarily evil. Reason is the supreme good and guide. And so their motto might have been more so to endure life and to look for reason. So it's really interesting that you have all of this take place on this hill, and you have all of this background, and it is very prominently and strongly held that that's where Paul is on trial. This, actually, corner is just part of the Areopagus, and it stands very close to the Acropolis. So Paul would have been in the Areopagus, surrounded by people of these different philosophical mindset who don't believe in a god necessarily, looking up to a place where there are all these pagan gods, idols, and temples. That's what surrounds him. So this is the Areopagus. There's the Acropolis. And here's just, again, some more. I believe that they're standing on the Areopagus. This is part of it as well. But what's really neat is if you went and visited today, here is a bronze of Paul's sermon that he preaches on Mars Hill. So when you hear that term or that phrase, Paul's sermon on Mars Hill, this is what we're talking about. That's just the bronze. It's actually even written, I believe, in Greek. And so couldn't read it if you went there, but you could see it, I guess. So again, one last picture, that rocky area That's where Socrates is has his trial. That's where Paul will have his. And so let's go ahead and read what Paul says. Verse 22, so Paul stood in the midst of the Areopagus and said, "Men of Athens, observe that you are very religious in all respects. For while I was passing through and examining the objects of your worship, I also found an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' Therefore, what you worship in ignorance, this I proclaim to you, the God who made the world and all things in it, since he is Lord of heaven and earth, does not dwell in temples made with hands. Nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all people life and breath and all things. And he made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, having determined their appointed times and the boundaries of their habitation, that they would seek God, if perhaps they might grope for him and find him, though he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own prophets have said, for we are also his children. Being then the children of God, we ought not think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man. Therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that all people everywhere should repent, because he's fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness through a man whom he had appointed, having furnished proof to all men by raising him from the dead." These are the words that Paul chooses to use to these groups of people at this location in Athens. He talks about this unknown God. We've looked at all the different, you know, gods there, how religious these people are. In fact, archaeologists have found an altar in the temple of Demeter in Pergamum that reads, "To the unknown God." So really cool that there even is in existence a find talking about an unknown God. You know, I don't know if it's, this isn't the same because this is in a different place, but just gives evidence to that being a historical aspect. But Paul will use that to speak about the one true living God, and that God is one that doesn't dwell in temples. Isn't that amazing? You know, he doesn't dwell in temples. He's not made out of something of gold or silver. Saying this around the temple of Athena, the Parthenon, the temple of Zeus. And that's what he's going to claim. And he'll say he's not far from each of us, which is very different from the Greek mythology of these gods on Mount Olympus who occasionally look down. And then he also mentions this aspect of God and his creation and what he does by offering this quote from Epimenides saying that he's not far from us. In him we live and move and have our being, he said, and he's not far from each of us. You are his children, is that quote from Epimenides. It's incredible to think about how Paul, as he's approaching these people, and he's going to really say some things that contradict, you know, their frame of mind, he does relate to them. You know, he doesn't just contrast everything, but he says, okay, you believe in an unknown God. Let me start there. Something we have in common. And as I'm giving evidence, you know, Paul, he's reasoning with them, right? They're people of logic and reason and talk about these things. Well, here's some proofs. You know, Jesus is raised from the dead. That's where he ends. But he'll also offer something that they're familiar with. You think about how Paul talks about in Romans, or excuse me, 1 Corinthians 9, "I became all things to all men," and how that extends into so much of his preaching, and certainly here. And it's kind of wild to think, as we begin to think of personal application, how some won't become acquainted with any other things. I'm just going to stick to the Bible, all that I know, not going to read anyone else's literature or a commentary from anyone else's frame of view. Paul knew it. Didn't mean he had to agree with it. In fact, he knew these things well enough to use them to come to Christ. And he finishes, again, of course, with Jesus. It's amazing how so many of the sermons and Acts finish with the resurrection. And even when Paul is talking to this completely pagan audience, that again is his crucial ending point. And I think this provides just some incredible applications. That first, as we think about Paul and as he approaches this territory, that boldness and courage are necessary to proclaim the gospel. Again, you think about what Paul would have been looking up at and walking into as he comes to Athens, and how he comes to this territory that's so far from his background. I mean, it takes boldness to cross the street and talk to your neighbor, to enter a house that, you know, is not yours. Paul entered a city that was completely pagan. And not only was he bold enough to go there and talk to them, but he was willing to challenge them and test their belief system. He said things that they didn't believe. In some ways, he called them out on their beliefs. You know, you're people that don't believe in life after death, that don't believe in a resurrection, some of these Stoics and Epicureans. You know, you're completely atheistic and materialist. You don't believe in life after death. We just go to the ground, and that's... Now, let me tell you about a God who resurrects from the dead. Let me tell you that there is something beyond just what we feel and see around us. It's not made of gold and silver, but there is a true God. And how really this kind of thing is so sobering when thinking about how cautious sometimes I would rather be when talking to somebody about Jesus or when talking to somebody about sin. You remember what Paul also uses as a big aspect of his sermon is judgment, a judgment to come. Talks about how important it is to seek him, but he mentions in verse 30, therefore, having overlooked the times of ignorance, God is now declaring to men that people everywhere should repent, for he's fixed a day in which he will judge the world in righteousness. God never excuses or condones sin. It's amazing to think about how sometimes we think, okay, because Jesus has come, you know, that means his grace is just that much greater and his love is that much more. But in some ways, it also means that we are that much more without excuse. That absolutely, you know, now that we do know more, now that the plan has been fulfilled, you know, now God's not going to overlook these times. You have the opportunity. The plan's been revealed. Now we absolutely have to repent. Paul didn't see their ignorance as an outlet for grace or mercy or an excuse for mercy. And Paul didn't say just because they don't know God and because he didn't know these people himself, this is a new town for him, maybe he should just leave things alone and let God judge. I think sometimes we get that idea that, you know, maybe ignorance is bliss. Maybe the less you know, the more mercy someone will have. So maybe I shouldn't tell them about Jesus. Paul looks at it the exact opposite. He says, no, you gotta know. You'll be able to live better. And really, now that God has made this evident, now he absolutely will judge. Paul, again, he tailors his message to his recipients, not only in what they hear, as far as being familiar and using the unknown God and epimet, but also in what they needed to hear. You know, because they're pagan, because they, you know, some of them are atheist, Now I've got to tell you about that specifically. You know, when he knows that people are engaged in something that is a barrier, that's exactly what he addresses, not what he avoids. And that goes the same way, not just with concepts, but with sin. When Paul talks to the Corinthians and writes those letters, he doesn't just talk about everything that they're doing good. He says, you've got problems, and I'm going to address those. And that's why he says what he says to these men at Athens and why he says what he says to that group at Corinth. This is what they need to hear. And ultimately, he shows that the wisdom of God is the power of Christ to salvation, despite that it may be foolishness to the Greeks. And that's what he says in the letter to Corinth as well. And certainly, this would just be completely erroneous to some of these Stoics and philosophers. We didn't even believe in an afterlife, and you're talking about a man who's come back now? We don't even believe in a God, and you're talking about a God that's not an idol, but a God that's out there and in here? But this is what Paul sees as completely crucial to having salvation. In the response in verse 32, now when they heard the resurrection of the dead, some began to sneer. Again, this is foolish to them. But others began to ask and say, we shall hear you again concerning this. So Paul went out of their midst. But some men joined him and believed, among whom were also Dionysius the Areopagite. So one who would have been part of that council, and a woman named Damaris, and others with them. You know, again, this resurrection is particularly something that's foolish to one of these groups. You really have kind of three different responses. Again, typically they believed in, if anything, an immortality of the soul, but not in a bodily resurrection. In fact, Plato and Aristotle really have been those who have been very influential, even today, of really Western Christians in their belief of afterlife, in the belief of heaven and ethereal bodies or spirits, you know, in the clouds. And Jesus shows that the resurrection is different. The resurrection is bodily. Now, it doesn't mean we know everything about that or have a perfect understanding, but that view is even something that's derived from Plato and Aristotle. Others say, we'll hear you again on this matter, and perhaps this isn't something that's necessarily sincere. You know, it could be just an excuse to leave, and on the other hand, it could be that, hey, you know, some things take time. And Paul realizes to some degree he doesn't have to give the entire plan of God and salvation in one setting. In some ways, a lot of receptiveness is going to demand time and seeking and interest enough to continue to hear and learn more. But regardless of how you take that one and certainly the other, you have a difference in some who join him and do believe. Damaris, perhaps it's named because this is someone that people would recognize, but Dionysius is a member of the Areopagus, is a member of that group that would hold people on trial and make different determinations. Tradition states that this person actually later became an elder at the Church of Athens. Now, there's great application from Paul and his sermon. There's great application from these responses. That even in a place like this, there are still people who aren't only just interested in listening, but willing to receive Paul's message of Jesus. And I think it just is another example that goes to show you that we have no clue who will be willing to receive Jesus until we preach Jesus to them. That the most unlikely of prospects may just be unlikely in our perception, and that's it. And you think about how incredible it would be for Paul to come into this place and to be on this area where, you know, men have died in trial and surrounded by these temples and have the boldness to preach about Jesus. Well, you know what's also really bold and courageous? To hear that message and believe it as someone who lived in that place. You know, a lot of times we really put a lot of focus and emphasis on the person who will speak. But man, you know, the same kinds of things that we appreciate, that's absolutely true of the person who listens. And to also be able to appreciate that when we're teaching. You know, just as hard as it is to come and knock on that door, it's hard to open that door and to say, yeah, I'll have a study. I'll come to some place where I don't know and listen to some things that I haven't heard. And then to commit a life to that? I mean, Paul, he's not the best example, but you think about us as far as maybe being a missionary. You go to China, you go to India, and man, it takes boldness and courage to be a missionary there. But most of those missionaries leave. What if you had to stay? What if you were a member of this court and this group, and now you're saying, I'm a Christian? That is incredibly courageous. And that's something we ought to appreciate. Not just about Paul and evangelism, but about recipients. It takes a lot to be willing to accept that. It takes a lot to have that Bible study and then to change that life. You know, thinking about this, We talk about the cost of discipleship and the sacrifices made to be a Christian. For some people, it really just depends on their background. If you're born into a family that has Christian parents that have been going to church their whole lives, it might actually be more of a sacrifice to leave Christianity. If that's who you know, that's who your friends are, etc. You know, and I think that there's probably a lot of us who are in that boat. Might be more difficult for us to fall away and more sacrificial from a physical standpoint to do that. For someone who doesn't have that background, that is way more sacrificial. We talk about the reward and everything, you know, the family that you gain. I mean, for some of us, you know, we're just keeping the same family, but just developing a deeper relationship. People on the outside coming in who haven't grown up knowing this, who don't have those Christian friends, that are leaving those lifestyles, those habits, those relationships, that are sacrificing. Perhaps maybe recognizing that, we can have greater patience when we're dealing with people who are leaving a lifetime of thought, habits, you know, what they know to become a Christian. Regardless, it's worth it to do that. And it's worth it to preach to those people in those kinds of places with those kinds of difficulties. And maybe it's because of all of those things that someone's ready to hear more, maybe to become a Christian. If we can help you in any way, if you'd like to study, you'd like to give your life as you've heard the message and are ready to receive salvation and be baptized and wash away sin, we'd love to help you. If you would, make that known as we have an invitation.